Welcome to the podcast for Empathy and Imagination. My name is Aubrey.
And I'm Drew Clark.
This is the show where we discuss various topics and learn to empathize and imagine with you, each other, and our guests. Welcome. This is episode 16.
Thank you very much, everybody, for being here.
All right, what do we got?
Well, I'd like to first check in. Aubrey, okay. How's your week been? How you doing?
Doing great. A little tired, but I'm doing well. My week's been good, busy, productive. How about you?
Feeling pretty good. Been working on stuff. Today's been fun. It's a beautiful day.
Here we are, Chateau Drew in Richmond, California.
Mm-hmm. The studio here.
I think we got some topics for you today.
We do. We have some things for you today, folks. We got a quiz.
Ooh.
We've got a sound to listen to.
Okay. Well, start wherever you want, okay, man. Okay. Yeah. Right, you want to start with a quiz or a sound or topics or any updates?
I wouldn't mind just doing a little garden update.
Garden update? Mm-hmm.
Garden update. So, we got a bunch of stuff living right now. Garden update is, last night I ate snails from the garden. I actually did the whole cleaning process. You can look up online, you feed them certain foods and you clean them, and then you feed them certain foods and you clean them, and then you know they're safe. You put them in the fridge and they turn into little balls, and then you boil them, deshell them, and then kind of saute them in buttery spice things.
So you have to clean them like 3 or 4 times?
Yeah, it's advocated that you have them eat food that you know isn't gross or diseased or weird. So you would clean out their systems and that's advocated.
Huh. So they metabolize whatever you feed them, and over the course of a week, their bodies are just composed of what you fed them, essentially? So there's no toxins in there or anything?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Is that the idea?
That's the idea. And so we fed them cornmeal and kale and other stuff.
Huh.
So there's a bunch of new plants living. There's all kinds of chard planted. There's all kinds of lettuces now. And basically everything has survived the transfer process. So, the snails were weird. I will try cooking them one more time. I will try one other method. They weren't like, whoa! It was weird. The consistency was weird. And it didn't taste amazing. So I was like, wasn't that thrilling?
Like chewy?
Very.
Yeah, that doesn't sound appealing at all. Chewy snails.
Well, if I was starving,
it's like eating turkey fat.
I'd make it happen.
Yeah.
And you know, like there was emotions. My emotions were running high, like getting ready to kill them. I mean, because these are living animals, yeah. And I had a kind of a moment there to sort of thank them for their sacrifice in a way, and killed them in boiling water instantly, and then ate them. And
how many?
I don't know, like a dozen or so.
Oh, okay.
I gave a couple to the dogs too. They were into it. Dogs loved it.
Did you harvest that whole bucket full?
No, there's still a bunch in there.
Oh, okay. And would you saute them in like butter, garlic,
bacon, garlic, and a bunch of garden herbs? We just basically
tried to kill the flavor of the snails with other flavors.
You know, it's almost like it doesn't have that much of a flavor. It's a little bit like abalone or something like that. It's,
yeah.
Except for the texture is pretty weird.
The texture is the off-putting part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The new compost is going well. The landlord sent me a very angry text in confusion, and I reminded him of our conversation. And so it's going well now.
Hmm.
He was like, there's a big hole in the yard. And I was like, well, remember we talked about needing a compost there, and I showed you how I would do it.
In the corner there?
Yeah. Behind the trash cans, there's this like partially cement, partially wooden box, basically, that I dug some dirt out of and found a bunch of drywall just in the dirt that obviously was left from construction.
Yeah.
And I'm cleaning that out and started a compost bin in there, and it's really working out. It's great.
Drywall, it's not attached to anything?
It crumbles. It just mixed in with the dirt in the ground. Like they were like had extra
and just
threw it there and
threw
then
it there.
Just left it.
Cool.
Yeah. So cleaning that up And yeah, I think that's my garden update.
So you have two composts?
We have two composts, yeah.
Cool. Thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
Garden update.
Okay, so I understand that you have a topic.
I have a topic. Should we jump right into that topic?
I just gave a pretty nice garden update. Why don't you give us a topic?
My topic today is Bucky. You know what that is?
Buckminster Fuller, one of my heroes?
R. Buckminster Fuller. The R stands for Richard. So he was a dick.
He was.
He was a Richard.
What? I could speak about that for a second.
Okay. Well, maybe some background information.
Dude, start with that. Yeah.
Born in 1895. Lived till 1983.
Hey, my birth year.
Yeah, right. He went away and you came into being.
Uh-oh.
He was, for those of you who don't know, he was an American architect, systems theorist, author, designer, and inventor. And he, kind of a bit of an eccentric, you know, would you say that?
Yeah.
It's true.
And systems theory, now that's kind of a thing that's becoming more popular now, too. And now old Bucky, as he's called, has become side famous, sort of, for things that are now becoming way more relevant. Like, of course, everyone knows the Bucky Ball. Now, what's the Bucky Ball?
The Bucky Ball. Well, the Bucky Ball is a thing. It's a geodesic dome, right?
It's triangles all together, sharing sides, building a dome.
Yep. The geodesic dome is a hemispherical thin shell structure based on a network of great circles. Geodesic means great circle. On the surface of a sphere or hemisphere, the geodesics intersect to form triangular elements which have local triangular rigidity and so distribute the structural stress throughout the geodesic sphere, which is pretty cool. Epcot Center, you know Epcot Center?
Mm-hmm.
That big ball, that's a Bucky Ball.
And Disney uses those too, correct?
Yeah, Epcot.
Yeah, that's the same
Disney
thing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
There's also, I think, the Montreal like Arboretum or something. There's a Montreal. There's one in Montreal. It's a clear one.
You know where there's a lot of them?
No.
Burning Man.
Oh, yeah.
Burning Man is covered in those things because people can just bring PVC pipe or rebar, whatever the substrate is, build the triangles, and then have domes all over the desert.
Yeah.
Some of them 300 feet high, some of them 20 feet high. It's all, it's
well,
all,
that's the, that's,
very scalable.
Yeah, it's scalable because you have tensional integrity. You have tensegrity in any, so you can basically have the dome be as large as you want. It scales up and down infinitely. And it's always able to support its own weight.
It'd be fun to have a greenhouse from that design. That would be, I think, great. I think they call those biodomes. Yeah, Buckminster Fuller, to me, was an important part of the story of Jacques Fresco. Jacques Fresco is a futurist, inventor, filmmaker, artist. He's a lot of things. He's really old, and he lives in Venus, Florida, and he is the curator of the Venus Project with Roxanne Meadows.
I think we mentioned him on a previous episode.
He basically followed Buckminster Fuller. He kind of, in my view, took up the socio-political space that Bucky held and took it in a more kind of futuristic, aggressive, creation-drawing sense. I think Bucky had a few inventions, too. Do we have any of his inventions?
Yeah, he was a weird guy. Unusual, I should say. He coined and popularized a few terms here.
Oh.
He popularized the term spaceship Earth. You ever heard that term?
I have. That's like a recent term. I've heard that in the last 5 years, I'd say.
Yeah. He didn't come up with that. There were a few guys before him that used that same phrasing, but he made it popular. Now, spaceship Earth is kind of a worldview term, encouraging people to think of the planet Earth as a spacecraft and the human population as a crew working towards a common good. So if you imagine the Earth as a spaceship and everyone on it is, you know, the crew of that spaceship, that was the idea.
How more accurate could it be? And that is what's happening.
Yeah. And he had a comment on the spaceship Earth. He said, the most important fact about spaceship Earth, an instruction manual didn't come with it.
Ah.
So we have to write the instructions to spaceship Earth. We got to figure out how to pilot this thing, navigate it, get the life support systems up and running and sustainable.
Sustainable there. That's the thing we're still working on.
Yeah. So that goes into his one of his other things, a word that he coined, ephemeralization.
Huh. What's that mean?
The ability of technological advancement to, and these are his words, quote, do more and more with less and less until eventually you can do everything with nothing. So another way of saying that would be you have increased output efficiency, but you require a decreasing number of inputs as technology advances.
That's like what economies try to do.
Yeah. So he saw that as a solution.
Yeah, I think that's a natural part of human experience.
Because the result would be ever-increasing standards of living for an ever-growing population despite finite resources.
Wow.
So if you can get more output for your input, that solves the problem of exponential growth of the population. So that's the cool term. He also coined a term, synergetics.
Synergetics.
Yeah. The study of systems in transformation. It's almost such a wide subject. Not a lot of scientists really study it because it's the study of systems in transformation, and we humans are part of a system, so it's hard to study the system of which we are a part, you know? So a lot of things that scientists study, like topography and topology, you know, biology, chemistry, all that stuff all of those things are systems. And synergetics would be the study of those systems in transformation. So it's a kind of a nebulous concept, but a very abstract and powerful concept, I think.
I like it.
He had some kind of idiosyncratic phrases, like instead of upstairs and downstairs, he thought those were inaccurate terms. Because there's no up or down in space, right? And I think he wanted to substitute those with
in
stairs and out stairs. You're either going in towards the center of the Earth, or you're going out, away from the center of the Earth.
So if you're in space, you're always being affected by some finite amount of gravity. So it's either in or out from that.
Mm. I think so. He might have just been talking about on Earth, but I remember that in stairs and outstairs, because we say inside and outside. It's a little bit different, but another one of his words was livingry. So instead of like weaponry, livingry. So
wow,
as opposed to weaponry, like weaponry which takes life, right? Livingry is life. That which is in support of life.
So like a garden, is that livingry?
Yeah, or like I don't know, even like a thresher or something. Be livingry. Anything that supports.
Wait, what's a thresher?
The growing of life. Like one of those big machines where they harvest wheat.
Okay, yeah.
Combine, is that what they're called?
I think there's several names. I mean, I don't know.
So livingry, that's kind of a cool
livingry idea. I like that.
You don't hear that every day. I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that word.
No. Oh, that's the first.
He was also the second president of Mensa International.
Huh.
Mensa, of course, the high IQ society.
Huh.
Started in England, I think. Gina Davis, the actress, she was a member too. So here's some interesting things. In the year 1927, I guess he would have been 32.
Huh.
Saturn return. He said he had an epiphany in 1927.
Okay.
Said that was the year of his epiphany. So this is from Wikipedia. In 1927, he felt as though he was suspended several feet above the ground, enclosed in a white sphere of light. A voice spoke directly to Fuller and declared, "From now on, you need never await temporal attestation of to your thought. You think the truth. You do not have the right to eliminate yourself. You do not belong to you. You belong to universe. Your significance will remain forever obscure to you, but you may assume that you are fulfilling your role if you apply yourself to converting your experiences to the highest advantage of others."
Hmm.
So purportedly, a voice spoke to him and said that. And Fuller stated that this experience led to a profound re-examination of his life. He ultimately chose to embark on, quote, "an experiment to find what a single individual could contribute to changing the world and benefiting all humanity," end quote. Kind of cool.
That's my kind of guy, man.
Yeah. Cool, cool epiphany to have.
That's my kind of guy.
It's like ego death.
Yeah.
You do not belong to you. You belong to the universe. I mean, that's kind of transcendental, isn't it?
It is. Those are pretty, I think those are pretty wise positions. I feel connected to their usefulness for sure.
To give yourself over to the betterment of humanity?
I think that that's one end of the scale and the gradient. And the other one is, you know, taking care of yourself at all odds. And maybe somewhere in between those two, there's some gradients that people can function in that are taking care of themselves and good for the world.
Yeah. I think we should all do that.
Nice.
Geodesic domes.
Good use of should.
He didn't actually invent that, but he did hold the patents.
Huh.
So that's why he's kind of known for the geodesic domes. Here's a summary quote of his own worldview. "There is no energy crisis, only a crisis of ignorance."
Wow.
So plenty of energy to get out there and inform yourself, people. No excuse for ignorance.
What else?
Oh, he always used this word, Dymaxion. A lot of his things, he'd call it Dymaxion this, Dymaxion that. Dymaxion is a portmanteau, which means a couple words put together. Dynamic maximum tension. Those three words put together, Dymaxion. So, this is interesting.
What is that?
He made this thing called the Dymaxion. It's just kind of a word that he used a lot. Sometimes it seemed more appropriate than others, but he basically kept a diary. Okay, so he kept a document of his life every 15 minutes from 1920 to 1983. That's 63 years, diary for 63 years.
Of every 15 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, not obviously not when he was sleeping, but...
But that's like an Instagram account of like a crazy person.
Yeah, he's like the first mega Twitter guy.
Wow.
But it was all private. You know? It's just his diary.
He didn't have it set to public?
No. He didn't have his profile set to public.
Why not?
You had to friend him first. But I think you can read the Dymaxion Chronophile. That's what he called it, the Dymaxion Chronophile.
How long is each entry, approximately?
Well, they say that the I don't know, but it's a huge document.
I bet.
And I think it's at Stanford. I think they have it in the archives at Stanford. Anyway, here's his quote on it. "If somebody kept a very accurate record of a human being going through the era from the gay 90s, from a very different kind of world, through the turn of the century, as far into the 20th century as you might live, I decided to make myself a good case history of such a human being, and it meant that I could not be judge of what was valid to put in it or not. I must put everything in. So I started a very rigorous record.
Wow.
A diary to end all diaries. Not even a diary, a journal. Document of events. The ultimate Facebook timeline, right? Before the timeline, before Facebook even existed. So he had other things that he used, the Dymaxion. Dynamic maximum tension, which to him meant maximum gain of advantage from minimal energy input. So that goes back to the whole ephemeralization concept. Lots of outputs for very little inputs. He had something called the Dymaxion car. You heard of that one?
No.
It was a kind of a teardrop shaped, big in the front, tapering back in the end.
That makes sense.
Three wheels.
Okay, I can picture it.
It's got a V8 engine, but it's in the back of the car. Three wheels, and it's got front wheel drive. And you steer with the rear one wheel.
Yeah.
So it's like a rudder. So you can do 90 degree turns. You can do really tight circles. Never caught any traction. No pun intended.
No one wanted it?
Yeah, there was like an accident. It was involved in an accident that got a lot of press, even though it wasn't the fault of the Dymaxion driver.
I wonder if we could provide a link to that.
And yeah. So like the guy who was driving the Dymaxion car died. So it got a lot of bad press, but it wasn't that guy's fault. It was the other driver's fault. But it never caught on. I think there's still one in existence. One of the first three that were built.
Do they still operate it, or is it just in the showroom?
I think it's just in a museum somewhere.
That's probably best. I don't want to drive it, though.
Yeah, that kind of sounds cool. I think it was like a really four, fun. You know, four or five people could fit in it.
You have V8 on a little teardrop thing. You could probably, with rear steering, I mean, that would be, you'd almost want some wind rudders too to help you out. That might be interesting to think about, you know? I don't know.
I think it was steel frame too, steel chassis.
Yeah.
The Dymaxion house was another thing that he came up with. It's kind of like a bell shaped structure, but you squash the top of the bell. And it was a house. It had revolving dresser drawers. Kind of cool concept.
I'm picturing combine
multiple drawers into one.
Yeah, I can see this, like this is interesting. I can see it. Yeah.
He also had, there was a fine mist shower.
A mister, eh?
Yeah, fine mist shower to reduce water usage. And the top of the house, the circular part of the house, actually rotated, and it used natural wind for cooling and air circulation. And of course, Dymaxion chronophile, that's what he called his document.
Well, how'd the Dymaxion house deal with poop? That's what I want to know.
I don't know.
Well, maybe we got to search that.
If anybody knows, you know, let us know. He developed in 1967, he came up with the concept for a floating city.
Ooh.
So, it's our kind of guy.
Huh.
Here. A lot of cool ideas. He, some quirks. He did a lot of traveling in his life, doing lectures. He would, like, lecture all the time. He was on tour lecturing, speaking most of the year, like 300 days out of the year. So he would wear three wristwatches. Okay. One for the office, his home office, one for wherever he was now, and then one for wherever he was going to be later. Also, he studied the sleep habits of animals, such as dogs and cats. Eh? Right, Inferno?
That's some dog sleeping with us right now. One on the floor with his head on a pillow, the other on a couch, snoozing away.
Yeah, and so he studied their sleep habits, and he was inspired by them. So he would for a period, he would work until he was tired and then take a short nap. So this resulted in him sleeping 30-minute naps every 6 hours. This allowed him 22 thinking hours a day.
Oh, my gosh.
Which aided his work productivity. Fuller reportedly kept this cycle for 2 years before quitting the routine because it conflicted with his business associates' sleep habits. So he had to fall in line with the
man,
the workaday world. Yeah. And although he no longer partook of the habit, in 1943, Fuller suggested that this type of sleep pattern would be a good strategy for the U.S. to use to win World War II. Huh. So he was like, we should adopt this and we'll win the war. Of course we won the war anyway, but interesting.
You try it out with the platoon maybe, you know.
Yeah. Just try it out with one platoon first. Let them go nuts, see what happens.
Yeah. So are we any final thoughts on how we feel about Buckminster Fuller?
You know, I find him fascinating. I think he's got a lot of good ideas and also a lot of like eccentric ideas that don't make a lot of sense, like in stairs and out stairs. I mean, it makes logical sense, but it's kind of like, it's kind of like that, you know, do we really want to fight that fight? Kind of like our language works already fine. So he's like a fascinating character to me. I think it's inspiring that he was such a humanist. Hmm. And he really felt that there's enough resources, there's enough to go around. And he saw our destiny as kind of, you know, getting off Earth. So, yeah, cool guy. I'm on board with most of his ideas, actually.
Yeah, well said.
You have any thoughts on him?
Yeah, I'd say he has influenced so much, so many people who have influenced me directly. I learned about him later on after I had already learned about the other people he had influenced.
Like Peter Joseph and Jacques Fresco.
Mm-hmm. Those people. And others, some others as well. It's really like he is such a spike on the graph of total awesomeness for well-meaning human thinking and cool idea production testing. It's like kind of a good example, I would say, of, I don't know, good human example, seemingly. Yeah. Primarily. I mean, I don't know how his close interpersonal relationships were. And very impressive body work. I think it stands the test of time. We'll probably be talking about him for basically forever, I estimate. Mm.
Yeah, another thing that's cool that I like about him is that he viewed his own life as an experiment. That's pretty cool. To be able to say, "Oh, I'm going to run experiments on my own life and my whole life is going to be documented and we're going to see what happens. How much can one person contribute to the good of humanity?" It's kind of noble goals he had there.
Yeah, that helps you sleep at night, I think. You know, yeah. That's cool.
It helps you sleep when you take 30-minute naps. Yeah.
Oh.
Buckminster Fuller. Yeah, I think there's a carbon molecule named after him, too? A certain...
I don't know.
Carbon configuration. It's called the Buckminster Fullerene. And I think it's a nano-sized geodesic dome made out of carbon. But I'm not sure. Anyway, yeah, that's my topic. Buckminster Fuller. Check him out. Very interesting character. A lot of cool ideas. A hero of the imagination.
It is now time for... It's quiz time.
Ah. Okay.
It's time for a quiz. Today, we're going to be quizzing Aubrey on... Shakespeare.
Huh.
We've got a list.
I'm no expert. Just let me quickly say I'm no expert. I'm merely an enthusiast.
We have a list here of roughly 11 questions.
Huh.
And if you get 7 of them right, you win a prize.
Oh, to be right about Shakespeare.
And
that's
your prize is a luminary. I'm just going to say that. It's a luminary prize.
Okay.
So, are you...
Don't know when he was born.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. When was Shakespeare born?
1594. I don't know. I actually don't know. I think I've read it, but I don't remember.
The answer is 1564, actually. Okay. He was born in 1564.
What did I say? 1594?
Yeah, yeah. You were close.
I was off by a Saturn return.
Yeah, you were off by a Saturn return. So that's a no. You don't get that point.
Okay.
So, wee, womp.
Okay.
How many plays and sonnets did Shakespeare write? Christ.
This is like the least fascinating parts about Shakespeare. 22 plays and 173 sonnets. That's not right.
The answer is Shakespeare wrote 37 plays and 154 sonnets.
Okay.
One play called Cardenio has no written record today. Only 36 plays.
Might be a collaboration with John Fletcher. Today. Yeah. How many can be read today?
36.
Okay.
So some of the, I think you were so in the zone for the kind of numbers that they were. Half point.
Okay, half point. I'll take my half point.
Thanks. Okay. Question number three. Was Shakespeare ever in love?
See, I don't think anyone knows the answer to that, but I would say yes.
That is correct.
It's just a yes or no. Okay. There's speculation on who, you know, the dark lady of the sonnets. Some say also the Earl of Southampton. He might have been crushing on a guy for a while, and also crushing on a girl for a while.
Shakespeare was in love. At age 18, he married 26-year-old Anne Hathaway. They were married the rest of Shakespeare's life.
That's right. She was like way older than him. She was like 30 and he was 18 or something.
26.
And he was 18?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See? Smart. Going after an experienced woman.
Number four. Who said, "Oh, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?"
That would be Juliet.
Oh,
yeah. Bing! That's totally correct. Mushrooms.
Okay. Number five. The line, "To be or not to be," comes from which play?
That's the play entitled Hamlet. Actually, it's called The Tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark.
Ding, ding, ding.
So, extra credit.
Number six. This is a multiple choice.
Okay.
Was Shakespeare born in A, Stratford-upon-Avon, on B, London, C, Venice, D, New York?
A, Stratford-upon-Avon.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, you don't have to check that one. I know.
Oh, now he's getting
it. By the way, this was totally unrehearsed. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know you were going to do this. It's cool.
Number seven.
Seven.
Was the globe, A, a Roman amphitheater, B, an Elizabethan theater, C, an Elizabethan sports stadium, D, a famous map of the world?
B. So Elizabethan theater.
The globe is an Elizabethan theater. Shakespeare partially owned when he performed many of his plays. A reconstruction exists today in the same suburb as the original in Southwark. Number eight. True or false? Was Shakespeare an actor as well as a poet and a playwright?
Yes.
Ding! That is correct.
He was acted in the Lord Chamberlain's Men. And after they got a new king in England, I think it was just called the King's Men. He was an actor, and some people say that he might have played the ghost of Hamlet's father.
Yeah, true. Shakespeare acted in his own plays before Queen Elizabeth.
I and King James I. Number 9, true or false, was the movie Shakespeare in Love a true story?
No.
That is correct. There is no historical evidence for the romance occurring in the movie. It may have happened, but Shakespeare was married at the time.
Yeah. The one writer who knew everything about us, we know nothing about him.
Number 10. True or false, is there a monument of Shakespeare in Stratford today?
I believe his memorial is there.
Ding. Last question, final question, ready?
Yep.
Did Shakespeare invent words?
Like coin words?
Did he invent words?
Yeah. A shitload of them.
That's true. Ding, ding. He invented the word assassination, amongst others.
The Oxford English Dictionary is very much made in Shakespeare's image. I think he used over 22,000 separate words in his plays. And it's always humbling to be reminded of other writers who used maybe 5,000 their whole careers. That's a cool quiz, man. Thanks.
We have a winner here, folks.
That was great.
We have a winner here. What do you win?
I don't know.
2 votive candles. Here you go.
Cool. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Nice. All right. Spark those up later. Cool. Did you have a topic too?
I do.
What are we doing?
I can do the sound or the topic next. Let's do the sound. Let's do a break. Okay.
Yeah.
So here comes a sound, and we're going to listen to it, and then maybe talk about it for a second.
Okay. Sounds good.
Here comes. Sounds good. God, sometimes you just don't come through. God, sometimes you just don't come through. Do you need a woman to look after you? God, sometimes you just don't come through. You make pretty daisies, pretty daisies, love. I gotta find what you're doing about things here. A few witches burning, it gets a little toasty here. I gotta find why you always go when the wind blows. And God, sometimes you just don't come through. Oh God, sometimes you just don't come through. Do you need a woman to look after you? God, sometimes you just don't come through. Tell me you're crazy, maybe then I'll understand. You've got your 9-iron in the backseat, just in case. I've heard you've gone south. Well, babe, you love your new four-wheel. I gotta find why you always go when the wind blows. And God, sometimes you just don't come through. And God, sometimes you just don't come through. Do you need a woman to look after you? And God, sometimes you just don't come through.
Sounds great.
That was a cover of Tori Amos' God by Clarity, my partner.
Huh.
She sang 3 parts there.
Clarity, is that a new moniker?
Mm-hmm.
How does one determine what one's moniker is?
You know, as I explored making my own moniker, it was sort of came to me in life.
I kind of discovered it and adapted it sort of as it happened.
Hmm.
And I said, and then it starts with trying it on. I tried it on, like calling myself Solipsis.
Why?
I felt like embodying something bigger than just myself, while like it's sort of a chosen name expression. It's kind of another way to express myself, to communicate, which is like meets a need.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So that sound, what did you think about that sound?
Sounded great.
Did you get any images?
Images of the kind of backing music, grooves. You know, groovy stuff.
Nice.
It's not really an image.
That's an image.
A mental formulation of sound. Images, I just pictured Rebecca singing that part into the microphone and then using the computer to rewind and overdub.
That's what happened.
And yeah, it's cool. Is there any instrumentation on it?
No, that's it.
That's it.
It was basically her very first attempt using the program. It was like, I remember my first attempt at using the phone to record music. It was like, I taught her the buttons, and then she made that, and I was like, all right, let's post it. Yeah.
What do you think about it?
I think it's cool. I think it shows some of her skill as a singer, and I'm glad that she now has the tools to record herself. She doesn't have to wait for someone else to do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was really pretty.
That is cool. Are you going to put instruments on it?
I think so, yeah. No.
Did she record it with a click track?
Uh-huh.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Sweet.
That was my idea. I was like, yeah, let's just do it to a click track so later we can add stuff, you know.
All right, so Drew's got a topic.
Topic. Okay.
Woo!
Okay. So, topic. Now, there's lots of things that this topic affects. It affects Aubrey and mine's life a lot right now. And I'm curious to talk about how it has helped, how it has been a challenge. What do we like about it? What don't we like about it? And kind of other, maybe a story about it. And the topic is unemployment.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in.
So here's the topic for empathy and imagination.
Oh, unemployment?
Unemployment.
Yeah, like not having a job.
Yeah, it's also this government money program.
Oh, the unemployment benefits?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done it. I've done it twice. Once in Massachusetts, once here.
Yeah.
Last time was, 13 years ago or something.
Yeah. How do you feel about it?
You know, I'm not sure how to feel about it.
Hmm. Yeah, it seems fair.
Can't let it dictate my feelings, right?
Right.
So you can't feel anything about anything. Because nothing controls your feelings.
How does that make it? You can't feel anything.
Just busting your labs.
I know.
Busting good. Your labes. why'd you bring up unemployment?
I just want to talk about it. So, to me, I feel like unemployment is this. Yeah, it's hard to know exactly how to feel about it. I'm very glad it exists, and yet I'm also very opposed to our total system at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, in that way, I am a bit contradictory.
Mm.
So I find it to be very helpful to provide existence since my job closed. That's been really great.
Okay.
It's also not enough to live.
Mm.
So you have to do other stuff while on unemployment, like spend things on credit cards or try to exchange things for things or sell stuff that you have. So you have to do something else.
It's not enough.
It's not enough to live. No.
Just get moved somewhere cheaper.
Right. But that costs a bunch of money to move. Usually a move is like
You could just sell everything that you have that you don't want, put everything else into storage, and live outside.
Okay. I think some people might go for that. But a lot of people wouldn't do that right away.
Right.
Some people probably sell everything and then just like maybe buy a minivan. And just live in that.
My point is just that it is a living wage if you scale back what you need.
It's not living to what you were working at to make livable continue.
You have to make sacrifices in order for it to be livable.
My experience is even with very large sacrifices, it is still below livable.
But like I said, sell everything, move out.
Yeah, if you do that. I mean,
yeah, but, so why not do that?
I think a lot of people would like to not be homeless. That's why not. That's why I estimate.
You could still have a home. You just live out of your van.
That's generally defined as homeless.
Okay. So what's wrong with that?
I think a lot of needs would have a hard time to be met. I think in that way. Because you can't really park it anywhere. So you're always going to be harassed.
So should unemployment be more? Should they give you more money?
I don't have a should about it. I am interested in the conversation of very happy that it exists. And it is also it's less than is possible to function, which is, I think, part of the idea.
Well,
because they want you to pursue, they want you to, you know, do something else, which I agree with. That's fine.
Yeah.
And I think my use of unemployment is one of the most traditional American things, which is to be at a job, have that job close, go on unemployment, try to start a business.
Mm-hmm.
That's like best case scenario.
Okay. But you don't vote.
No.
And you disagree with the whole socioeconomic system.
Correct.
Yet are complaining that it's not enough to live on.
I would venture to say, from my experience, it's not a complaint. It's an observation.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm very... I think a complaint would necessitate me wanting it to be something else. I don't know what else
it would be. So you're fine with the way it is?
I'm existing in some sort of way, and I don't really have a complaint.
Mm.
It's more like an observation.
Okay. Well, I challenge the observation because I don't. Again, you could move out. Yeah, I mean, I guess most people would find it to not be a living wage, unemployment.
Well, you said you challenged
because it's always going to be less than what you made.
Yeah, and that's part of the deal. But a moment ago, you said you challenged my opinion or observation. You said I could, should, some, what'd you say?
I said living wage is subjective. So even the observation that it's not a living wage could be proven false because you could live on it.
Yeah.
And you could actually live quite decadently on it.
I agree. That's possible.
But yeah, I guess for most people that collect unemployment, it's not enough to live on.
Yeah.
And like you said, that's probably part of the point is here's enough to cover your needs. Now get out there and get a job.
Hmm.
Or start a job.
Mm-hmm.
Start a business.
Hmm.
So yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't know where I really fall on the whole issue.
But you have some feelings about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it.
Well, you're currently collecting unemployment.
If it's honest, I guess it's good. I mean, it's good, I suppose. Is it?
You're currently collecting unemployment, correct?
Yes. Okay. But doesn't it prop up the whole socioeconomic system? Just the idea of unemployment? I mean, it's part of the system. It's propping up the whole thing. It's not separate from the system. It's part of the system. It might just be one leg of the system, but it's there.
Well, having a job is a leg in the system.
So is unemployment.
Yeah, they're all legs in the system. I agree.
it's keeping you in the system. It's keeping you subservient to the system, the socioeconomic system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but it is doing that.
Well, aside from good or bad, there's probably a story that could be told about unemployment, otherwise known as fun employment.
Hmm.
Whether or not it's good or bad, there's probably a story.
You have a story about it?
I was thinking. I was wondering if you did, too.
This is your first time collecting unemployment?
The first time I collected unemployment, I was in high school.
Huh. Okay.
It was like $80 a week or something.
So what was the job that you had in high school?
I was working at the Lake Don Pedro Marina, Fleming Meadows, California. Fleming Meadows. I was working there. And then they said they were going to hire me year-round, so I got a car and insurance. And then they were like, never mind.
Mm. So you had all this debt stuff from the car and the... You had insurance payments, car payments.
Yeah, I had all the stuff to pay for. And I was like, okay. And I applied for unemployment, and they gave it to me. Very small amount.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's cool. Did it help you get back on your feet?
Uh-huh. It worked out. I like finished that off, and I was able to still have the car to go to school, and it worked out.
So it can be helpful.
Yeah.
When I say good or bad, I mean helpful or harmful. That's generally the way I use those words.
There's a lot of things in life that I think can be both.
Sure.
Ingredients. And then there's a whole swirly.
Of course.
Yeah.
Made up names. Good and bad.
Maybe.
Helpful and harmful.
Hmm.
You have to be employed in order to get unemployment.
Yeah. You have to
have had
a job. You
can't just be unemployed and never have had a job.
Right. You have to have paid into the unemployment thing.
Yeah. And, I don't know all the intricacies of unemployment either. At the dispensary, a lot of the people who help patients purchase medicine
mm-hmm.
seem to recognize the unemployment card. They seem to be familiar with it on a personal level, and they seem to come across it a lot in their everyday interactions and transactions. With clients, with patients.
Patients. They're both. So
that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
People are just using their unemployment for that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Is there a solution that would better meet needs that's not unemployment? Like apprenticeship?
I mean, I can think of lots of cool ways that, like apprenticeship type things.
Oh, you just got fired or you just got laid off or you just whatever. Well, there's an apprenticeship program. You want to learn about, this or that?
Mm-hmm. If you could also pay your rent during that time, that'd be cool.
Luthier. The apprenticeship comes with room and board. You want to learn about building guitars?
Well, you can kind of do that at farms. Sometimes if you can manage getting and somehow storing all of your items or selling all of your items or whatever it is, there's like farms you can go kind of live, work at around, all around, especially California.
I mean, you could sublet your apartment.
Mm-hmm. We do.
I mean, for a long time. 6 months.
Could do.
For the duration of your unemployment, live out of a van, sublet your apartment.
Store up some major dough.
Yep.
Buy a Firebird.
Although I suppose if you're making money from subletting, you wouldn't be able to get unemployment anymore. But
depends on how you sublet it.
You get the idea.
Yeah.
Buy a Firebird. IROC Z?
Yeah, I'm getting an IROC Z with all the money.
Fiero?
I want an IROC Z with a 3D3 stroker painted white with all the fins.
454? Four barrel?
383.
Four on the floor?
Five on the floor.
Mopar cam?
That's no. You're a dozen.
Mad carburetor?
You don't know what you're talking about.
What is that? Fiero? Is that what it was?
No.
No, do you remember that? Remember that though? Is that what the car was?
There is a Fiero, I believe. But it has nothing to do with a Firebird.
Yeah. But I mean, do you remember that car?
The Fiero?
Yeah.
Wasn't it small? Is that a small two-door car that was like...
Yeah, it was a piece of shit.
It's crappy.
Yeah. But it was kind of like...
Kind of sporty.
Yeah. Again, buying into the narrative. Anyway. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe the solution is like shared work.
Hmm.
I mean, why are there people who aren't working? Why the fuck aren't we working?
The unemployment rate is high.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
Because of the system. It's mandatory for the system to have that.
Hmm.
If the system exists, so will unemployment.
Hmm. Why do you say that?
There's no way for the money to change hands any other way, but including losers like musical chairs. There always will be losers of jobs, of companies, of fortunes, of savings. It's built in.
Hmm.
Have to be able to change money around to keep the economy going, quote.
Hmm. When was the lowest unemployment, do you know?
1492.
Okay. When it was no one here.
Yeah.
No one was doing shit.
No, nobody was in America. Were here, and they were people, and they weren't employed. They lived well though. And then
yeah.
Other people came in and they were like boom boom drugs, guns, boom boom. And then they're like, jobs. And they're like, why? And they're like, because money.
Mm. Yeah. Why do you think it is? Control?
I think that the assertion of gaining more and more control and massing more and more things is a tragic expression of an unmet need of an actual human biological thing to be able to have safety.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
Hmm.
And in this case, spice is essentially money.
Yeah.
And it was one of the good old presidents who said that. He signed the Federal Reserve into existence and immediately regretted it, and said that, yeah, we're basically fucked now because all the power is in the hands of the bankers.
Yep.
Sorry.
Whoops.
It was maybe Truman or Roosevelt. Totally understood that, oh shit, that was a bad decision to create the Federal Reserve, which is not federal.
Mm-mm.
It's about as federal as Federal Express, right?
Right.
So, yeah, and it seems like it was just a power grab by, tycoons and magnates. They said, well, if you control the money, you control everything else. And that's essentially borne out, I think, in the years since. I think there are better ways to meet our needs.
Probably.
A lot of them have been tried. You know, Burning Man is one way. But again, why isn't there a 365 days a year, 24/7 Burning Man? Is it because it's actually not sustainable? That's my question. That's my skeptic mind is that, well, maybe that's why it's not constantly happening, is because it's not actually sustainable.
Well, once you go, you'll know much more.
Yeah. I hope to learn about it.
Yeah. It's very sustainable. A lot of people adapt it, and there are groups all over the world that do smaller things that are based on its principles. All over the world, and there's many just reach out groups, like people who just help in emergency situations, all kind of who are all burners. And there's doctors and clowns and builders and everything, and they're all kind of basically using the methodology to try to improve lives and meet needs.
Right, but there's no Burning Man City.
Well, there is Black Rock City.
I mean, there's no permanently established municipality that espouses the Burning Man ideals.
But I've actually heard recently there were people thinking about doing it.
Question mark.
Yeah,
I don't know. But
I think there was some people talking about it.
Like, you know, Berkeley's seen as the quirky, liberal, weird part of America, right? Mm-hmm.
Berserkly.
But even Berkeley's super conservative.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really that liberal.
Not really.
It's like kind of conservatively liberal.
Hmm.
There's a lot of liberals who are hardline liberals in Berkeley. Yeah. I won't say it annoys me. I'll say it's an observation.
Okay, there you go.
Observation, yeah. Yeah, unemployment. Oh, man. Is it an incentive to get a job, or is it a disincentive?
It is both.
Yeah.
It's both because it allows you a break from the 9-to-5 life, which you realize you desperately want to escape from.
Mm-hmm.
So it gives you that. But it also, many people find at the end of it that it's fucking time to get a job. And so they get one and then move on at some point.
It seems like net negative effect.
You think so?
You get a break and you're like, oh, fuck, the 9-to-5 thing sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a positive thing for someone to experience? Knowing that, like, oh, I have a reprieve. Oh, I can see finally in my life. Finally can see out of my eyes. In 6 months, I'm going to be blind again. But, wow, this is pretty cool.
I think it's
okay, time to be blind again.
Yeah, that's a sad story. But I believe...
Isn't that the story, though, that we're living?
They build up over time, though. Like, imagine, like, say what I'm doing. Say other people were like, oh, instead of going back to the 9-to-5, to do something else.
Right.
Some other creative thing.
Well, that, yeah.
So that, I think, is a... We can't know if it's a net positive or not, but I estimate just the break alone to be able to open your eyes and look at your life and go, okay, what the hell?
Okay.
I think it's a net positive, yeah.
Okay. So the socioeconomic system does have positives.
Yeah, it has lots of positives. Yeah. We got us so many great things we would never have had if it hadn't have been existing when it did.
Yeah.
And it provided many essential changes and learning lessons, and we've outgrown it.
And we'll save that topic for another time.
Okay.
It's a deep topic.
I like it.
A lot of questions on that topic.
Yeah, do we have a question?
Do we have a question?
Did you have one? We could think of one.
Think of one.
Question.
Do you think unemployment meets more needs than it denies?
That's a good question. Cool. Do you think unemployment meets more needs than it denies?
Check out the website, empathyandimagination.com, and, you know, comment and suggest future topics. Today's episode is brought to you by
Final Corp.
It'll be fine. These are fine purveyors of mayonnaise, misters, and raspberry carbonated mayonnaise flavored sports drinks. Final Corp. Thanks for supporting us, Final Corp. And thanks everybody for listening. Really appreciate it. Be sure to like, subscribe, follow, unlike, unsubscribe, unfollow,
comment.
And then comment, and then resubscribe, refollow, and re-like us. Thanks. Good night.